here, and I've been asked to fill in for the colloquium. So today I'm going to talk about the relationship between gravity and non-equilibrium thermodynamics. So if we go back to Bronstein, who was the first worker in quantum gravity, Bronstein drew this Bronstein cube of physical theory, which includes G Newton, the speed of light, and H bar. And if you look at this cube, it looks like there's nothing further away, from quantum gravity than non-equilibrium thermodynamics, which is really at this other corner. So it seems pretty unlikely that there could be any relationship between these two completely opposite subjects, at least opposite in the sense of this Bronstein cube. So this is what we're going to explore here. Now, what happened is that there seems to have been, over the years, lots of evidence for a correspondence between at least black hole physics and equilibrium thermodynamics. And the question I want to investigate here is whether this correspondence is just an analogy or there's something deeper going on. I want here to give evidence for a deeper correspondence that extends not only to equilibrium thermodynamics but to non-equilibrium thermodynamics. And such a correspondence, if it's fully understood, can provide a beautiful physical picture of gravity, as I'm going to try to convince you. But it can also give us maybe a clue on quantum gravity constituents, since thermodynamics is about, averaging over some fundamental constituents. And if really we can make these correspondences, it allows us to do gravity experiment in a lab using, soft physics. So let's start with the black hole physics. So we know that if we take two very massive objects which are spiraling around each other, then gravitational force is going to kick in, and they're going to be an orbital decay of these two masses. During this orbital decay, there will be gravitational radiation, which will enhance the decaying of the orbit. At some point, there will be a merger of these two objects, and then a black hole horizon form. Once this black hole horizon is formed in an arbitrary shape, then there's a ringing down of gravitational emission that's going to reduce this black hole to its spherically symmetric shape. And then those systems settles down into a static black hole configuration. And this is the expression of the theorem that black holes have no hair. There exists a simple description of all information that fall in, which is forgotten classically, and we always end up into this spherically symmetric configuration there. So what's startling about this process that has startled people for many years is the fact that this story here looks very much like what happens when I steer a pot of water. No matter what I do to a pot of water, I put it out of equilibrium. Then the second law of thermodynamics is going to tell me that it's going to relax towards equilibrium in a pre-settled manner. And the end state of this evolution is an equilibrium state. So black hole looks like equilibrium states in that respect. Now, if we look more at the gravitational wave production, so we know that if you have a ring of particle, gravitational waves is going to deform them in this ellipsoidal manner. This is what's happening. The inspiral wall will produce this regular wave. At some point, there's this merger phase, and then once the black hole formed, there's an exponential ringing down of black hole, which is maybe we want to relate to this relaxation toward equilibrium. Now, every perturbation of a black hole finally settles down to a statically spherically symmetric configuration. This is analogous to the statement that any non-equilibrium system finally settles down to equilibrium. And the question is whether this ringing down of black hole is the same as the process of relaxation to equilibrium. And can we, if that's so, then the next question is whether we can understand the production of gravitational wave as entropy production mechanism. The reason a system relaxes towards equilibrium is because it produces entropy in the system. And the reason a black hole settles down to its configuration is because it relaxes gravity wave. And can we also understand this process quasi-locally, locally to the system and not taking into account the whole space-time? So now the evidence that people have gathered so far about black hole thermodynamics is mostly up to now what I would call a thermostatic evidence. And it goes back to Bardeen, Carton, and Hawking that expressed the fourth laws of black hole thermodynamics. So these laws express the fact that black hole can be considered object at equilibrium in the sense that we can assign a temperature to them, and this temperature is constant across the horizon. This temperature is identified to be proportional to the surface acceleration, the radial surface acceleration that you would experience near the horizon. Black hole under change of their shape or parameters satisfies the first law of thermodynamics that says that the variation of mass proportional to a variation of angular momenta times angular velocity times a term that looks like TdS. And that motivated people, and Bekenstein in particular, to identify the entropy with the area in Planck unit. And the second law of thermodynamics expressed the fact that the area of black hole always grows. So in any process where we merge black holes, this area always grows. Now, the original proof of this first law of thermodynamics, for instance, started by comparing two different space-time with different mass and different area. And then there has been lots of more elaborate proof, which are more physical in the sense that they look at a process. We start with a black hole configuration, we send something in, and then we look at the configuration after it settles down. And we compare two different states of the black hole at different time and see how the mass change under this process. And the process is always tuned to not produce any gravitational wave. And under this such a process, you know, the black hole horizon grows if you send something in, and this is how it grows. Okay. So now the second law expressed the fact that the total sum of matter entropy plus the horizon entropy, which is the area of a 4G, always increase. That's another piece of evidence. And at the quantum level, what really nailed down this analogy is the fact shown by Hawking, but also the property shown by Unruh, that at a quantum level, a black hole radiates at a temperature which is proportional to its radial acceleration. And similarly, this is the Unruh property, an accelerated observer experiences a thermal flux proportional to its acceleration. And the main mechanism for that is that if you have a pure state, so if you have a black hole or an accelerated observer, you're going to have an horizon, which is depicted here. And if you have your pure state that lives on the left and right, a segment of your slice, then for an accelerated observer, the accelerated observer can only see the right-hand side of the state. And if you trace out the left part, you're left with a mixed state, and this mixed state is really a thermal state. And the temperature of this thermal state is proportional to the acceleration. And this is essentially due to vacuum entanglement. So this is a very robust property of quantum system in the context of gravity. Now, okay, these are, you know, nice and old evidence, but all this evidence is essentially equilibrium evidence, whereas when we talk about entropy is really about understanding how entropy is produced. The concept of entropy is useful when you want to describe how a system goes from out of equilibrium towards equilibrium. And this process of relaxation to equilibrium is the process of entropy production. So understanding really entropy means that you understand the process of entropy production. And this is what the challenge here. So now the question is whether we can understand gravitational evolution as entropy production happening in a physical system. And more generally, there's an open question in the field, which is that nobody really knows what is the entropy you should assign to a general gravitational system. Okay, so let's look why gravity and entropy are somehow special. If you look at the time evolution of non-gravitational system, this is what it looks like. I take a complex system, I put it in a clumpy state. This is a state of low entropy. And then, you know, it's going to diffuse and expand towards a state of high entropy, and this is my equilibrium state. I'm going to show. So let's move. So far, you know, when there are gravity. So this is the goal. So if you look at a non-gravitational system, this is how evolution looks like. If I show you a movie of a non-gravitational system, you know, it always goes towards a more disordered states, and it always ends up into an equilibrium system, which is this homogeneous system. Now, there's a fundamental puzzle that was raised acutely first, I think, by Penrose, which said that, well, if we look really at the initial data for the universe, and we look at the WMAP Planck satellite data, the conclusion of this data is that the early universe, as far as the matter content of the universe is concerned, is a perfect black body. And in fact, this is the best black body template we experimentally have. Okay, yeah, okay. WMAP, Planck, COBE. I mean, all these results are confirming each other that we have this a perfect black body radiation. And in fact, you know, anyway, I don't want to go into the detail, but in fact, this is even the Planck result shows that the non-Gaussianity are even, you know, lower than we expect. Anyway, so the puzzle is the fact that if we have a perfect black body is a system at equilibrium, and we just say that the system at equilibrium by definition do not evolve in time. So this is the main puzzle, because we exist and we are the result of the evolution of the universe. So if this was the only entropy content of the universe, there is a fundamental puzzle, because an equilibrium state do not evolve in time. Now, what happens is that if we look at a gravitational system, and we look at what is the typical time evolution of a gravitational system, it looks exactly the reverse of the system we just draw here. What happens in a gravitational system is that if we start from a very homogeneous state with very slight inhomogeneity, this inhomogeneity are going to be non-linearly enhanced and then end up into a clumping state. And this process of clumping the matter here is a process where we start from having a system with low gravitational wave, very low gravitational wave, to a system which has a high level of gravitational wave. So this picture is suggestive. That is, can we? It suggests it begs the question whether we can understand gravity wave production, which is really what's happening when we go from here to here, as an entropy production system, in order to be able to understand the evolution of a total matter plus gravity system as really respecting the second law of thermodynamics. And when we look at that, it's clear that the mechanism at end here, you know, which is responsible for this clumping, is the fact that somehow gravity cannot be screened and gravity is universally attractive. But we can ask why gravitational systems are so special. What is so special about gravity? And let's turn on to that. So the main thing which is, before describing, you know, what is so special about gravity, I want to be a bit more precise about the type of system I'm going to study. I want to provide a quasi-local description of gravitational physics. Let's say I want to describe what happens in this room, but taking into account the gravity physics too, without referring to the end of space or the end of time. So I want to do things quasi-locally, which means we choose a domain, let's say this room. This domain has a boundary, which I call the gravitational screen, which is this boundary of this room here. And this boundary evolves in time. And this boundary just spans a time-like world tube here, on which there's a preferred field of Eulerian observer. And this time evolution of the screen is a time-like surface. So this is, and generally I can look at a region which has external screen and internal screen. And S here denotes the direction orthogonal to the screen. So now the main punchline, which is the subject of this talk, is the following. What I'm going to show, what I want to show to you, is that the gravitational dynamics of the region inside the screen, so the gravitational dynamics of whatever happened inside this room, is entirely encoded into its two-dimensional boundary. It's entirely encoded into the screen. And from the point of view of the screen, this dynamics is absolutely equivalent to the non-equilibrium dynamics of a two-dimensional viscous bubble subject to Newtonian gravity. And this picture here, the fact that we can displace whatever happened in the interior to what happens on the boundary of the interior, is reminiscent of something called the membrane paradigm that was developed earlier by Damour, Price, and Thorne. So here, what I'm doing is somehow extending and making this picture more precise. Okay, so the fact that we can equivalently describe the dynamics of gravity in terms of this boundary dynamics in terms of a viscous bubble, relies heavily on the fact that a gravitational screen possesses two physical quantities that are characteristic of the physical quantity describing a physical interface. And a physical interface will always be characterized by the fact that it possesses surface tension and internal energy. So now I'm going to focus on surface tension and internal energy and show you why gravity possesses a surface tension and what is the physics associated with surface tension in a physical system. So what makes gravity special compared to any other force of nature is the fact that gravity is holographic. And it goes back to one of the key elements of the theory of gravity, the fact that we have the principle of equivalence. This principle says that locally, we can always eliminate the gravitational field. So in order to see that, let's try to compute the total gravitational plus matter energy of a region R here. In a usual physical system, when you compute this energy, there's a contribution coming from the bulk, and there's a contribution coming from the boundary. In usual physical system, the bulk scale like the volume, the boundary like the area. So we kind of, for large system, we just ignore this boundary contribution. Now, in gravity, what's so special is that the bulk contribution always vanishes. No matter what you do, the bulk energy is always zero. So the total energy is purely a boundary contribution. This means that somehow what's at play here is that gravity provides some kind of energy screening. Any form of energy that I put here in the bulk is going to be screened by gravitational energy. And this form of energy is going to rearrange itself to cancel the energy I've injected in space. So the usual notion of energy that we used to is valid only if we neglect the gravitational contribution. And this is also one of the reasons why gravity is impossible to screen, because it doesn't really, you know, create energy in the bulk. Now, the way to understand that and to reconcile that with our idea that, well, there are local notion of energy that makes sense is to take a thermodynamical analogy. So in thermodynamics, we also know that there are two forms of energy, and the total energy is always conserved in any system. But these two forms of energy are split into energy that are usable, which is work, and heat energy. So the idea here is to show that somehow the form of energy you're used to is analogous to the work form of energy, whereas the gravitational energy, the unusable form of energy, is analogous to heat. Now, technically, the reason why the Hamiltonian is always zero in a bulk is essentially the expression of diffeomorphism invariance, an arbitrary change of coordinate, especially an arbitrary change of time, doesn't change the physics. And for a closed universe, the consequence is that the total Hamiltonian vanishes identically. OK, so now if we try to compute what is this form of energy for a bounded region, we can do the computation. And the total energy of the system will contain a mass term and an angular momentum part. Let me forget for the moment for this talk about angular momenta, let me just focus on the mass. And the mass term here is going to be, the mass term is going to be a purely boundary, it's going to be given by a pure boundary contribution here. And what happens is that if you do the computation, you find that this boundary contribution, which makes the appearance of a surface tension here, is essentially the radial acceleration of the screen and the radial acceleration compared to Eulerian and freely falling observer. I mean, this definition of the mass of the observer for an arbitrary screen, which here expresses the fact that it's purely coming from the boundary, agree with all the possible definitions of mass that appeared in the literature. So we know there are different definitions of mass in the literature, which depends on what type of screen we choose. So if we have, for instance, a Killing vector field, time independence, the mass is called the Komar mass. If we put the screen at infinity, it's called ADM energy. If you put a null screen, it's called Bondi energy. In the Newtonian limit, we have the notion of Newtonian energy. All this energy just comes from this single formula. This formula is essentially a generalization of the definition of mass that you would naively give in the Newtonian a setting, in a Newton setting, the Newtonian potential, the Newtonian acceleration is essentially gm over r squared. So if you multiply this by 4 pi, you know, over r, 4 pi r squared, the total area of your surface, you essentially get in a gravity unit the mass of the region inside. And this property of holography essentially shows, and the fact that energy is purely a boundary contribution, and the variation of energy is also purely boundary contribution, is the expression or makes appear this notion of surface tension here. And surface tension appears to be radial acceleration. Okay. So what we want to investigate further is what does it mean physically for a screen to possess a surface tension. But before we do that, I want also to investigate this other key property that is characteristic of gravitational system, which is the property of internal energy. Not only we want to be able to assign to this boundary gravitational screen surface tension, but we also want to assign internal energy. And internal energy is somehow coming from the fact that in a thermodynamical system, the fact that the system is made up of constituents. So in order to do that, it's good to go back to trying to find what is the simplest expression of Einstein equation. And by that, I mean, is it possible to express? We all know that Einstein equation is usually presented as a very technical and very cumbersome, mathematical, complicated form of equation, which is very hard to explain to high school students or lower. So what I claim here is that trying to understand this notion of internal energy or thermodynamical analogy forces you to get a formulation of Einstein equation which is amenable to understanding by high school students. So that's the goal here. Now, until now, it was very general. I'm going to talk about evolution later. Yeah. So until now, it was at a moment of time, what is the energy of the system? Yes. Yes. That's what I'm going to show. Yeah. So, but first, let's try to find the simplest expression of Einstein equation. So in order to do that, let's say that we start by considering a plate or an array of freely falling test particles that I put, you know, in a disk or on my plate here, and which are initially at rest in this frame and forming a little, you know, let's say, area like that. So if nothing is happening and if there's no matter going through, if there's no gravity perturbation, then, you know, it's going to stay like that. What I'm going to do now is have a transversal look at this little disk. So transversally, it looks like this line here. And what I'm going to do is look at what happens to this test particle, test particles, when I sense any form of energy in. So let's say some moment, it could be light, it could be my laser, it could be a matter flowing through. It doesn't really matter. It could be, you know, any form of energy going through this little screen here. So clearly what's going to happen is that if there's any change here, happening to this array of particle, this change is going to affect the curvature. The curvature is the inverse of the radius of this object. And at linear order, any change is going to be linear in the curvature. So essentially, at first order, the change of shape is a change in the curvature of the curve here, and which is a change in, you know, proportional to 1 over r. Now, if I take another transversal look, which is perpendicular to this one, I'm going to get a change which is 1 over r prime, which is also the change of curvature of the transversal direction. By azeotropy, the change of shape of the area should be characterized by, there's no preferred direction, so it should be characterized by the average of the two, which is called the curvature, which is the sum of 1 over r plus 1 over r prime. So this is here a very general statement. I'm just doing absolutely nothing. It's just a kinematical statement that any change of a plate will be proportional or measured by the amount of curvature here. Now that we have expressed that, the Einstein gravity equation can be expressed fully in plain English, which was the goal I was having here, without any equation and without any approximation. And Einstein equation can be rephrased like that. The rate of change of curvature is proportional to the flow of transverse momenta. So that's absolutely intuitive. If I send more momenta, the change is going to be bigger. Now, the Einstein equation comes from the fact that you demand that this change of curvature is as the same magnitude. So the proportionality coefficient between the flow of transverse momenta and the change of curvature is universal. It's the same for all possible inertial observer, and it's negative. The negativity means that when I send matter like that, it curves, you know, in this concave form, which essentially is the expression that gravity is attractive. Gravity is trying to follow through the amount of matter going through. This is exactly Einstein equation. And with some amount of work, you can try to explain that to a high school student. Okay, so now if I put back the equations where we are more used, the rate of change of curvature is proportional to the flow of transverse momenta, and there's a universal constant, which is minus 8 pi g. And this is how G Newton arrives. This is this universal constant here. And if we continue here, the rate of change of curvature is essentially the time derivative of theta, the curvature of the, which is essentially proportional to the integral of the momenta, the momenta in the r, you know, in the r direction, which is the integral over the little surface of the stress tensor, the RT component of the stress tensor. Now you can convince yourself very easily that this is essentially the RT component of the Einstein tensor. And since this equation is valid in any frame, it implies this equation, which is Einstein equation. So what we're saying here is that Einstein equation is equivalent to a form of energy conservation. If we assign for every screen like that a notion of internal energy, which is essentially proportional to the curvature of the screen, the radial of curvature of the screen, then Einstein equation is essentially the conservation of energy, saying that no matter what matter energy is sent through the screen, it's compensated by the change in its internal energy. So Einstein equation is written here as a first law. Okay. So this, let's go back to now, let's go to, so this shows somehow that we can assign to a thermodynamic screen not only surface tension, but internal energy. And that Einstein equation can be expressed in this thermodynamical manner, which is also somehow the simplest form of Einstein equation. So let's go back to this system, you know, which is bounded by my screen S. So in general, it will be characterized by a mass density, an angular momenta density, and an area density. So I put here the area density because Hawking, you know, tried to convince us that somehow the area is some form of entropy. So the time derivative of the area is what I'm going to call the Hawking entropy production. Okay. So now in a dynamical system, in general, this mass angular momenta area or Hawking entropy production are not conserved due to matter and gravity wave flowing in and out of the screen. Okay. So the non-conservation of these quantities can be written, and that answers the equation, entirely from a two-dimensional perspective. So you don't need, in order to write these equations, to make reference to the bulk. And it is, as I already said, equivalent to the non-equilibrium dynamics of two-dimensional viscous bubble in the presence of Newtonian gravity. So before showing you that, I need to spend some time showing you what are the equations characterizing the physics of viscous bubble. Okay, so let's start with the physics of interface. Okay, so if we have a system which is at the interface of two fluids here, the interface is going to have a new parameter characterizing its property, which is the surface tension. The surface tension is due to the presence of constituents, and more precisely, the fact that the constituents are polarizable. The fact that they're polarizable means that they're going to be a short-range interaction, attractive interaction, between different constituents in the fluid. Okay, now at the interface, if you look at the bulk molecule, you know, it has many neighbors. But if we look at an interface molecule, this molecule is missing half of its interaction. So there's a deficit of energy there, which means that the surface is always going to try to minimize its area. And this is where the surface tension definition enters, is that the surface tension is defined as the energy that needs to be supplied to the system in order to increase the area by one unit. And the surface tension is really a measure or is really due to the presence of constituents or attractive constituents. Now, as we're going to see, the surface tension from the point of view of the two-dimensional boundary acts as a negative pressure. So if you're not familiar with surface tension, you might be familiar with the concept of pressure. So a negative pressure is the same thing as a surface tension. And the surface tension is responsible for many of the physics you witness every day when you go out of your home and you come here, which is the physics of droplets, bubbles, foam, evaporation, wetting phenomena, capillarity adhesions, etc., etc. This is one nice example of how you use surface tension. So what are the main equations of surface tension? So let me start with maybe the one you know the least, but which is the most powerful one, which is called the Young-Laplace equation. So suppose you have let's look at a bubble like that here. So suppose this is a bubble, which is, which has this curvature. And what happens is that I'm going to have a certain amount of pressure outside the bubble and a certain amount of pressure inside the bubble. Now, the question is, what is the relationship between the inside pressure and the outside pressure? And the Young-Laplace equation essentially tells me that if I look at the difference between the pressure outside and the pressure inside, this difference is proportional to the radius of curvature of the bubble. And the proportionality coefficient is the surface tension. So what does it mean? It means if I have a spherical bubble like that, I'm going to have, which means that the radius of curvature is positive, I'm going to have overpressure inside the bubble. This is why, in the air, if you take a bubble of water, they are very hard to sustain because they're very high surface tension. There's huge pressure inside and explode. This is also why, let's say, when you buy champagne, you're going to pay way more for having a good champagne has always a radius of bubbles, which is smaller than not so good champagne. So what you're paying here is for higher surface tension or higher pressure here. Now, imagine now that I have a surface which has negative radius of curvature, like a menisk here. Then what's going to happen is that I'm going to have, instead of having an extra pressure here, I'm going to have a depression inside the fluid. This depression is going to create an attractive force that's going to suck the two plates here. And this is the phenomenon of capillarity adhesion here, which could be very effective. Okay, this phenomenon is also responsible for if you open a faucet and you let the water drop, you're going to see that it's very, very hard to keep just a very cylindrical shape of the water droplet. It's going to nucleate and create these little bubbles here. And this is called Plateau-Relay instability. And it's very easy to understand according to this law because you see that, when I have this shape here, at this neck here, this is a negative curvature. Because it's a negative curvature, I'm going to have a depression inside, which is going to increase how small the neck is. And otherwise, when I have a bulge, I'm going to have another pressure, which is going to increase that. So this is the source of instability, which is happening here. Another place where surface tension appears is when you look at wetting phenomena. So you know that if you have a dirty floor and you pour water, it's going to make a puddle like that. But if you put soap, it might extend. And this is why you wash your floor with soap, because you lower surface tension. And by lowering surface tension, what happens is that if you have an amount of liquid on a solid, there's two surface tension which are competing. The one is the surface tension of the solid, and the other one is the surface tension of the liquid. If the surface tension of the solid is stronger than the surface tension of the liquid, then the liquid is going to spread, and it's going to wet your surface. If not, it's going to make a little menisk like that. Okay? And this is also this presence of surface tension, and the angle of the menisk is characterized by this ratio of surface tension. This is also what happened, you know, when insects are on top of water. The presence of surface tension or the interface allow them to use the surface of water as we would use a trampoline, and then stay on top of it. And another, you know, nice expression is if, let's say, if you have glass and you put water, so water has a tendency to wet on glass, so it's going to create a film, a menisk, which is like that. Now, if it's curved in that direction, what happens here is that what I have inside the fluid here is a depression. And because I have a depression, this depression is going to be strong enough to suck up the fluid to support the weight of the water column here. And this is why, you know, you have capillarity rise. Now, another, this description here was some kind of studies description of surface tension. But suppose now you create some fluid which has a gradient of surface tension. This gradient could be due to concentration or due to temperature. Then what happens is that if you have a gradient of surface tension, you're going to witness a flow on the surface of your fluid. So let's say you take a glass of water, you put some pepper, and then you make a drop of soap, you'll see the pepper just go away. And what happens is that the flow is, there's a flow in the interface which is always towards high tension. And this is where surface tension acts as a negative pressure. So the pressure, you know, if you have a system with pressure, the fluid is always going to go towards, you know, the lowest pressure, whereas here it's always going to go towards the highest tension. And which means there's an equation which is akin to Navier-Stokes equation for the boundary momenta, where here, instead of having the derivative of P, I have the derivative of sigma. And now, as I say, you can see that by how, you can witness that by how things diffuse on the, if you put soaps on the surface. Another very nice example is the tears of wine example, which is that if you take a very good crystal, which has very high surface tension, and a very good wine, what's going to happen here is that the crystal is wetting the wine liquid, so the liquid is going to tend to form a film here. Now, when it forms a film here, alcohol evaporates here. So on the top, we have more water, and on the bottom, I have more wine. The surface tension of water is higher than the one of wine, which means that the Marangoni flow is going to suck up the fluid upstairs, creating a little droplet here that finally is going to fall under the gravitational potential. And this is an example where you put a little soap, you know, inside a cavity, then, you know, your soap boat is going to move away from it. Now, this was the static, you know, of equilibrium configurations of bubbles. But now suppose that the sum of the out pressure plus the surface tension term doesn't match the internal pressure, then the bubble is going to move or nucleate. And you see that in beer, in champagne. And this is the process of cavitation or nucleation in a liquid where the pressure falls below the vapor pressure. And this is the principle also in the bubble chamber in the old detector, particle detectors that was used there. So you're going to have nucleations of bubbles, and the rate of expansion of this bubble is governed by the fact that the acceleration of the bubble is essentially this force, and then there's a friction force here. It's also this relay, and this is called Relay-Laplace equation, which is a dynamical version of Young-Laplace equation. And this equation is also very important in one of the most fascinating phenomena of this bubble, which is the phenomena of sonoluminescence, where you send high-frequency sound waves into a liquid, and that create bubble nucleation that collapse at very rapid rates. And then at some point, these bubbles create a flash of light. And this flash of light is the smallest black body radiation spectra we know. It's about 10,000 Kelvin, and the size is a tenth of a micron. Okay, so this was somehow this equation, Marangoni flow equation and Relay-Laplace equations, plus the first law of thermodynamics. These are the three equations that governs the dynamics of interface when it's non-viscous. When it's viscous, when, let's say, the interface possesses some viscosity, then there's an extra phenomena, which is the fact that there is internal entropy production. So in general, for a general fluid is always characterized by two tensors. One tensor is called the viscous stress tensor, and this represents the internal forces, viscous forces that are at play inside the liquid. And then the other tensor is called the rate of strain tensor, delta, which essentially look at the variation of the velocity field in your system. So the stress tensor represents the force, and the strain tensor represents the flux. Now, there's a very general theorem in thermodynamics, in non-equilibrium thermodynamics, that say that the entropy production rate is always given by the product of flux times force. So let's say if you have a one-component fluid and there is no heat force, so let's say there's no gradient of temperature, then the entropy production is essentially the contraction of the viscous stress tensor with the strain tensor. And the second law says that this object is always positive. This is the expression of the second law. This is a very general statement, true for any continuous system. Now, the nature of the fluid, whether you're talking about water, mud, milk, butter, iron, whatever, is essentially encoded into the relationship between the viscous stress tensor and the rate of strain tensor. How does the viscous stress tensor change when I change the velocity fluid? Okay. So for the simplest fluids, which are called the Newtonian fluid, which are the study, for instance, of Navier-Stokes equation, you assume that this relationship is linear. But in general, you have a way more complicated system. You can have system with memory where it depends on delta, but delta dot, delta double dot, etc. And essentially, all physical systems are entirely these constituent equations, as it is called, represent the nature of the fluid under study. Okay, so now let me summarize what I have. What are the three equations governing the physics or the non-equilibrium physics of system with interface? These equations are the following. The equations I will have for a viscous bubble will be the following. First, I will have what I call the Marangoni equation. But the Marangoni equation is essentially the equation which expresses the conservation of momenta. So there's a conservation of momenta, there's a convective factor. There's a term which is the pressure, force acting on it. And there might be external force. If there is viscosity, there's also a viscous force acting on the fluid. Okay. The other law that's going to apply is the first law of thermodynamics, which says that the internal energy of the system varies in time via a convective factor, and then there's a PV term, and then there's maybe a heat flux if you're heating the system. And on top of that, there is the entropy production term here, which is the contraction of the stress times the strain. And this is where, the fluid internal entropy production appears here. And finally, as I show, there is an extra equation, which is this Young-Laplace equation that describes the equilibrium of the bubble, but also the Rayleigh-Plessy equation that describes how the bubble evolves when the pressure are not equilibrated appropriately. And there's a generalization of this equation which also involve the presence of viscosity, that is, the presence of strain and stress, which looks like that. So this is the Young-Laplace term, this is the acceleration term, and then there are extra terms due to presence of viscosity. Now, the main statement here is that the Cauchy equation, which is conservation of momenta, the first law, which is conservation of energy, and the dynamical Young-Laplace equation, Rayleigh-Laplace equation, these three equations are absolutely equivalent to the gravity equations projected on the screen. And the gravity equations projected on the screen would be you take the Einstein tensor, S represents the radial direction, and you're going to have three equations, one where the second index is either tangent to the screen, this is this one, where the second index is really the time direction, or the second index is the space direction. And so this shows that there is, we can read the gravity equations as really the thermodynamical equation. So let's say if we focus on conservation of energy or the first law, we can write what is the general first law for a gravitational screen in the most general dynamical situation. And it will look like that. There will be a variation of energy, you know, so which is proportional to a variation of area, and the proportional coefficient is the surface tension. So the fact that there's a, so we have seen that the internal energy, if we recall the simplest expression of Einstein equation, is essentially the radial expansion. Yeah. Okay. So this variation of energy contains a term which is proportional to the surface tension, and the surface tension here is the negative two-dimensional pressure is equal to the radial acceleration. That's the correspondence. Now, there's going to be a term which is due to the fact that there's matter energy entering or leaving the system, and this matter energy is essentially the flux of momenta through the system here. There's a term I won't describe too much what's going on here, but essentially, your system is on a, you can compare your system is on a slice, and there's a notion of Eulerian observer. There is observer at rest with respect to the frame, I mean. And because of that, you can assign a notion of Newtonian potential to the screen. And this Newtonian potential is going to gravitate with a mass, which is the proportional to the internal energy. And, okay, so that's the usual terms. And now there's a term which is the term of fluid entropy production. And this TDS term is essentially the usual entropy production for a two-dimensional fluid here, which is the contraction of stress versus strain. So what's interesting is to continue the gravitational dictionary and see that in gravitational physics, we do have exactly the same form of the equation. What happened is that the rate of strain, essentially the normal vector or the time vector is the velocity vector. So if I compute the, if I have a two-dimensional surface embedded in four dimension, there is two normal directions, the time direction and the radial direction. For each normal direction, I can define the notion of extrinsic curvature tensor or shape tensor. And the shape tensor associated with the time direction is the special derivative of the velocity. So this is really the rate of strain. Now, the shape parameter associated with the radial direction, what's remarkable is that it appears in the gravity equation as the stress tensor. So it looks like the existence of this correspondence between gravity and thermodynamics is because we can clearly identify what flow is, and there's no ambiguity with what flow is, but we can also identify what are the Newtonian forces. And the Newtonian force appear as flow in the radial direction. And we also see that essentially this term here is really from the gravity point of view, the rate of production of gravitational wave. But from the fluid point of view, this is the internal entropy production. So this is in that sense that the fluid entropy production is equal to the gravitational wave production. So we can continue show a very precise dictionary between the physics of interface, so for instance, the internal pressure and the gravitational physics. So the internal pressure is the radial acceleration, the external pressure is the radial stress tensor, the internal energy is the radial expansion. Now we have seen the rate of strain is the temporal extrinsic curvature, the viscous stress is the radial extrinsic curvature, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So every element that appears in the thermodynamics of interface also appear in the gravitational system within this analogy. So this is where I conclude. We have seen that due to its holographic nature, gravity in a box can be equivalently described in terms of its boundary, the screen, and this is where gravity is really special. Now, a screen possesses a surface tension, an internal energy. From the screen point of view, that is, from the point of view of an observer that really lives only in the screen, Einstein equations are rephrased as the fundamental laws of thermodynamics, plus a fundamental law for evolution of the Hawking entropy production rate. That is the fundamental law that expresses how the bubble expands. And then the evolution of the Hawking entropy rate is a bulk equation that can be interpreted as a dynamical Young-Laplace equation for the screen in space. Now, these bring, you know, new lights on the nature of gravity, a new point of view on non-equilibrium physics, and new questions. For instance, we have two different notions of entropy production, the Hawking entropy production and the viscously fluid entropy production. Understanding the nature of entropy means that we know that this notion of entropy agree near equilibrium. But the question is whether, you know, they are the same in a non-equilibrium regime. Now, another, you know, question is that from the point of view of gravity, I didn't really emphasize that, but when you change the screen or the position of the screen, what you're doing is changing the constitutive law of the fluid. So you can go from, you can transmute water into mud or into a more complex element. And it's interesting to understand what is, and this is a big mystery in thermodynamics. Thermodynamics is well under control, but there's one principle that is absolutely not under control and that creates lots of debates, is what are the principles that determines the evolution of entropy production rate. For instance, one of the most popular proposals is that the reason a system goes from out of equilibrium to equilibrium is by choosing a path which maximizes the entropy production rate. So being able to nail that down from the gravity point of view might help what happens from the thermodynamics point of view. Now, you know, this is a very nice analogy at this point, but does it give us clues towards quantum gravity? And clearly, we don't know at this stage, but one hope is that somehow we could do what Einstein did for proving the presence of molecules. That is, this was proven using fluctuation dissipation theorem. The fact that we have a dissipative system is always due to the presence of constituents. This is the idea behind fluctuation dissipation. And then, is it useful? That is, could it? Yeah. No, but that's the thing, is that these two things are related. That's the beauty. These two things are related. So the relationship between fluctuation and dissipation is due to the presence of constituents. So now, a last question is whether this is useful. That is, whether, you know, I could go back to the original motivation, and instead of asking Louis Lehner to do a costly numerical simulation of how two black holes ring down, whether I could use this fluid analogy to really do it in a more effective manner. And yeah, let me stop here.
Thanks, Laurent. Are there any questions from the PSI students?
A priori, yeah, no, there's, I've been presenting all of that in a two-dimensional setting, but most of the equations I've been writing down are valid in any dimension. There's going to be some, you know, the detailed analysis of these equations is going to change. For instance, when you go to 4 to 5 dimension, the stability of black hole is changed. Because now you can have this ring shape, which have this plateau relay instability, for instance. But most of this analogy stands in any dimension.
Thank you. Your discussion, Laurent, was entirely classical, right? It was about classical general relativity.
Yes, it's entirely classical.
You introduced the notion of Hawking entropy, defined as the area of the screen. But the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy that we know is a quantum quantity. It has h-bar. Mm-hmm. And the whole story of black hole thermodynamics has to do with quantum effects. Can you comment on this?
Yeah, I can comment on that. This is why, I mean, you're right. You cannot define somehow the notion of entropy classically. But what exists classically is the notion of entropy production rate. So even if S is the quantum quantity, TS dot is a classical quantity. So this is what I was talking about. I was talking about evolution of the entropy production rate, which is the only thing I can access at the classical level. So that was somehow the purpose of this analogy is to investigate the following. Suppose, because we don't know yet, suppose that somehow, Hawking entropy is a real entropy. Okay, so this area of 4 pi g, which is identifying very special configuration, is a true entropy in the sense that somehow it's the useful notion for more general system. Then, if that's the case, there should be a sign of that being true at the classical level, which means that there should be a sign that whatever physical entropy production rate you're identifying is related to this Hawking entropy production rate. And what this analysis shows is that, personally, I'm not conclusive on that, in the sense that this is why I call it entropy production rate, which is essentially, I mean, A dot, right? This Hawking entropy production rate, or A dot, seems to be different at this stage from the... So in this fluid analogy, I have a fluid system. Because I have a fluid system, I can identify here what is the real fluid internal entropy production term, okay, which is the flux times force. And at this stage, at this stage, it's not clear to me that somehow Einstein, Hawking conclusion extend to the general setting. This is maybe the next slide that I didn't want to show here, that in my presentation, I'm somehow going away from identifying entropy with area, in the sense that the reason people identify entropy with area at the classical level was because there was a term in the first law which was proportional to the area variation. And then they interpret this surface tension as being a temperature, and therefore the area as being, an entropy. What I'm saying here is that this is a misidentification. There is an entropy production term, but this term should be just identified as a work term due to the variation of the boundary. So I think this is an ongoing investigation about what is the nature of entropy in gravitational system.
I guess closely related to what you just said, if I happen to choose my screen to be the event horizon of a black hole, I guess I'm free to do that, if I understand.
Yeah.
Do your equations simplify somehow? Or?
Yeah. Then, if you look at a black hole system, so you can take this general equation. So for a black hole system, what's going to happen is that, okay, there's going to be no Newtonian potential here. Now, you're going usually to look at a process which doesn't address any viscosity here. So there will be no internal entropy production here. And also, you're looking at a black hole is characterized by the fact that its rate of expansion vanish. So if you send a null ray, it neither contract nor expand, which essentially means that this term here, the internal energy, also the variation of internal energy also vanish. So then you will conclude that delta E matter is sigma delta E, delta A. Right. So for black hole, you get an equation, which is the equation that people usually got, which is this equation that delta E matter, so the amount of matter is equal to sigma delta A here, which is what people identify with, it should be the pressure up here. This is somehow this equation that forces people to identify A as the entropy and the pressure as the temperature. But what we see here is that this is not the proper identification. So it's perfect. There's nothing wrong with the usual derivation. It's perfectly valid. And this one is just more general. But it's just that the usual interpretation is a bit more subtle. Yeah, I think in equilibrium, there's lots of evidence. I think Hawking, the quantum evidence is very robust. So at equilibrium, the entropy is the area. Now, the question is what happens when you look at changes, right? This is where you want to go. You want to go beyond just this equilibrium picture. So at equilibrium, yes. I mean, I think the Hawking or the Unruh, you know, expression should show that, you know, the splitting of pure state behave as a perfect black body with a temperature proportional to the surface acceleration. So now, maybe to clarify that, so what has been the belief up to now, or what has been the evidence up to now, is the fact that what I called surface tension here is usually called temperature. Okay? And what I'm saying is that you should not confuse surface tension with temperature. Okay? The confusion is understandable because of the following equation, which is called the Gibbs equation. So if you have a system with interface, and that's going to answer why the equilibrium interpretation is true, it is true that the derivative of the surface tension always varies with the temperature. And now the derivative, the slope of variation, the derivative of surface tension with respect to temperature is equal to the entropy per area. Okay? So in a system where, in a physical system where the entropy per area is constant, independent of the temperature, it is true that somehow the surface tension is equal to the temperature up to constant. Okay? And this is somehow what a black hole system, so this is how you can reconcile the fact that surface tension, in general, this is not true. The surface tension is different from the temperature in the same way that you know, the specific heat is different from temperature. I mean, in specific system, they're just proportional to each other, but that's very system dependent. So what it means is that for black hole, this suggests that the Hawking identification is correct, means that essentially the entropy per unit area is constant. But in general, that you're going to have a more, you know, elaborate relationship.
So I was wondering how holographic is it? I mean, is it really an independent, the boundary theory description of the bulk?
In some way, yes, except that if the boundary, so in the usual holography, as you maybe are familiar with, which is ADS. So if you take a screen in ADS space, and you put this screen at asymptotic infinity of ADS, what happens is that this screen has very specific property because ADS has some reflective boundary condition. Any matter you send in goes back. So an ADS screen at infinity is somehow acts like a mirror. It's a purely reflective screen, which means that somehow nothing comes in and nothing comes out, which means the general description I was giving here is a description which is a thermodynamical description, right? Things are there's entropy production. It's not an Hamiltonian description. So the system I have on the boundary is not an Hamiltonian system. Now for ADS, what happens is that if you push the screen to infinity, because there's no dissipation, it turns out that this, you know, boundary description is also an Hamiltonian description. So this is what you gain. So the answer is yes, but in general, you won't expect this boundary description to be another Hamiltonian system. Okay, it's going to be a fundamentally thermodynamical description.
Okay, so Laurent will be around for some time at PI for further questions and discussions, which he looks forward to. And I guess we will have tea and finger food in front of the bistro. So let's thank Laurent again.